Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this time, we take a look at the Army's current downsizing plan. That plan will take the service down to 450,000 active duty soldiers by 2017, its smallest size since before World War II. Military leaders have consistently said that force would be big enough to execute the current defense strategy, but only at the lower ragged edge of risk. A new analysis from the federally funded RAND Corporation begs to differ, though, and finds significant shortcomings in the force's plan to meet three major defense missions the U.S. has already promised it would execute: combating terrorism, deterring aggression, and preventing the spread of weapons of mass destruction. Timothy Bonds, the vice president of RAND's Army Research Division, delivered that message to a recent meeting of the Commission on the Future of the U.S. Army. He joined me by phone to talk more about his testimony and the analysis behind it. Tim, thanks for joining us. And maybe a good way to start this is if we could talk a little bit about the current size, or rather the planned size of the active duty force, rather, and how it's being used. Because I'm not sure the Army always does the best job of explaining exactly what you need, for example, in the generating force to have an army of 450,000 active. What are sort of the commitments and the things that go on behind the scenes that tell you that not all those people are going to war all at once?
That's a great question. Let me answer that by talking about what I regard as the four major pools into which the U.S. Army active component is placed. First of all, there are forces that are forward stationed. There are 28,000 soldiers that are forward stationed in Europe. 55,000 are forward stationed in the Asia Pacific. That includes in Korea and Japan. But it also includes troops that maintain a forward position in Alaska and Hawaii. There are also 44,000 troops that are conducting operations around the world. These include the troops deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, the Persian Gulf, the Baltics, Africa, and other places. One interesting thing about those soldiers is they're rotationally deployed. By DOD policy, soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines are typically deployed on a 1:2 ratio. That means for every time period that they're actually in a country, they have two time periods away. Now, the time periods away aren't necessarily at home. That includes the travel time to and from a theater, and it includes training time that may be away from home station when they're back in the United States. But at a 1:2 ratio, it takes 132,000 soldiers to keep 44,000 active in a contingent theater. And that's 44,000 conducting operations, 44,000 just back, and 44,000 more getting ready to go. And I can talk some later in the interview if you're interested about what the effects are of stopping those rotations in the time of war. But the Army also has 143,000 soldiers in what it calls the generating force, or the institutional Army. Let me break those down for you.
Sure.
Those include 63,000 new recruits, soldiers that are new to the Army, or officers are in cadets at the military academy. It includes 44,000 soldiers that are organizing, training, and equipping the force, but also developing that future force that the Army may need to provide to the nation for an unexpected contingency or crisis. And so I call that part of the force the Army's capabilities factory. I mean, that's really where these capabilities are developed.
Mm-hmm.
But it also includes 40,000 soldiers that, at least for part of their day, provide support to joint missions and national activities. Those include the 23,000 soldiers that are assigned to Army Medical Command. It includes 8,000 soldiers that are in joint duty billets, and that includes Chairman Dempsey. He actually is accounted for as part of the Army Generating Force. There are some soldiers that are assigned to each theater and assigned to other national security agencies and other governmental organizations. And then there's some that provide a variety of kinds of support to the Corps of Engineers and other places, in total about 40,000. Lastly, there are some additional soldiers that provide support in CONUS to current operations. The Army lists 16,000 of them. And then there are 92,000 soldiers that are in the Global Response Force or Regional Line Forces or available for new missions.
And so that's a great explanation. But all that to say, there is not a huge amount of slack in the system if we had to go do something major around the world.
No, Jared, there is not. And I can talk about that some too if you'd like.
Yeah, let's get into that a little bit later, but let's talk about the current fort sizing plan, because that drawdown to 450,000, I think, as you point out, is based on the assumptions that were made in the 2014 QDR around three major existing commitments, but some of those areas have gotten scarier since then. Talk about what's changed since the QDR was written.
That's a very important point. I'm glad you asked me that. What's changed is this. Since the QDR was written, ISIL has emerged as a threat. If you look back at the language in the QDR, it mainly talks about the need to continue to combat the persistent threat of terrorism. It talks a lot about Al-Qaeda. Turns out the Middle East is in much worse shape than we assumed in the what was described as the rebalance in the 2014 QDR to the Asia-Pacific. Taliban remain a threat to the government of Afghanistan, and the rise of ISIL and its seizure of population centers really wasn't anticipated. The other thing that happened, of course, was Russia's invaded the Ukraine. There were indications during the QDR that Russia was not, respecting the sovereignty of its neighbors, but that was really before it was clear that there was a conventional Russian attack. President Obama subsequently described the brazen, assault of Russia on the territorial integrity of the Ukraine. And the concern here goes beyond Ukraine and earlier conflict that Russia had with Georgia, but it really extends to what the Russian intentions may be in the Baltic states. And so that's a brand new threat. The Baltic states are NATO partners. The president made an unequivocal commitment to ensuring their territorial integrity. He said it in a particularly poignant way. He said, "You lost your independence once before. With NATO, you will never lose your independence again." So that is new since the 2014 QDR. I might mention a third thing, and this is more a growing and changing threat rather than an entirely new one.
Mm-hmm.
Back historically, we would think about the North Korean threat against South Korea in terms of a conventional invasion. That threat seems to have receded now. I mean, the South Koreans can probably handle that with some help, from U.S. air power and maybe limited ground forces. But the threat now, and the one that you'll read in the papers today, and you yourself have probably reported on, is that North Korea has taken more and more to beginning provocations with South Korea. In 2010, they fired 80 artillery shells at Yongpyeong Island. They killed two South Korean Marines and two civilians. But it really changed the character of the relationship. If in future attacks, the South Korean military command has instructed their frontline commanders that they should respond themselves. They have the authority to do so. And they've told them to respond in measures of 3 to 5 to 1. So for every one shell fired upon South Korean soil, they should respond with 3 to 5. The problem with that is that could cause an escalation that spirals out of control. DoD has estimated that there are 8,000 guns and multiple rocket launchers that are within range of South Korea, many within range of Seoul. At one time, DoD had estimated that North Korea could maintain about 500,000 rounds per hour on South Korea without moving any of their guns from their hardened positions. That would be the kind of barrage that South Korea would have great difficulty in stopping by itself and would probably require U.S. forces. This is in addition to the North Korean nuclear program, which brings with it a threat of proliferation, particularly if North Korea were to collapse, either as a result of economic hardship or as the result of a war. Those sites, there are up to 200 sites, a former South Korean Minister of Defense had estimated. Those sites could become vulnerable to theft and proliferation to others, including violent extremists.
Let me go back, if I can, to the NATO commitment that you mentioned. Of course, the Army has already started positioning forward, stationing some forces in the Baltic states to try and deter that Russian aggression. But talk about what your analysis shows would be needed to actually defend those states if Russia launched a real invasion compared to what we have available in Europe now.
That's another good question. We've looked at this a few different ways, and our estimate is that against currently positioned forces, or the forces that could get there rapidly, the Russians would still be able to get into the Baltic capitals in 36 to 60 hours with the forces that they have available in their Western military district. What really is required on the ground in order to prevent a rapid overrun would be armored forces. And in specific, we think that in addition to the other NATO forces that could arrive quickly, we think that on the day the war starts, you're going to need at least one armored brigade combat team in each one of the Baltic nations, along with the other combat forces that normally come with, you know, an armored force, in the right kind of headquarters that can actually coordinate combined arms fire and maneuver combat. Now, that would be enough to prevent the quick overrun. It wouldn't be enough to completely defend the Baltic nations. There would need to be additional forces. We estimate that probably an additional 14 NATO brigades would be required in order to defeat a Russian invasion and you know, return to the status quo ante, if you will, to the pre-war borders. Half of those probably from NATO, half of those probably from the U.S.
And not to belabor this too much, but realistically, you know, how likely is it that Russia would launch an actual invasion into a NATO country where there are already U.S. forces, you know, pre-stationed?
Impossible, really, for me to say. I don't think I could give you a sensible estimate, and I really don't think, you know, there are many, if anyone, that can give you a good prediction. Who can really get into President Putin's mind? I might have told you 18 months ago that it was very unlikely he would actually invade Ukraine with conventional military forces, but here we are. I think the question that I would, the comparison that we have made in our analysis is, what is required actually to make it difficult enough for him to invade that it would cause him pause if, in fact, that were his intent? As a colleague of mine put it, if President Putin were to look right now from Russia across the Baltics at the Baltic Sea, what he sees now, there are a few forces there. There's a company-sized element from the U.S. in each one of the Baltics, but that's very small. What he mainly sees is some strong language from NATO. That they will defend the Baltics. What he needs to see is a certain war with NATO if he crosses that border, with a high degree of uncertainty that he's going to win that war. That actually comes at a fairly low cost in terms of the forces that we would have to commit. An armored brigade in each one of these countries is very small compared to the forces that we had in Western Germany during the Cold War. And so the way we prefer to look at it is, what's the investment needed now in order to really forestall or prevent or deter a Russian invasion? A Russian invasion, an actual war, would come at huge costs. And so we compare the costs of, you know, deterrence or prevention against the costs of that we would have to bear if it actually came to a war.
That's Tim Bonds, the Vice President of the Army Research Division at the RAND Corporation. We'll come back and talk more about his analysis of the actual end strength needs of the U.S. Army after a short break and why he thinks the Army is becoming too small to meet the commitments policymakers have already given it around the world. This is On DoD on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servian. Back on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Picking up now where we left off in our conversation with Tim Bonds, the Vice President of the Army Research Division at the RAND Corporation. We're talking about the Army's current downsizing plan, 450,000 soldiers by 2017, and his new analysis that suggests that's about 100,000 soldiers shy of what the Army actually needs to perform its missions around the world. Before the break, Bonds told us things have changed in the world since the 2014 Quadrennial Defense Review was written. That's the document that laid out how DoD would meet the national security strategy. Most notably, Russia invaded Ukraine, and President Obama promised NATO members along the Baltic Sea that the U.S. military would make sure they didn't meet the same fate. But Bonds says the Army would need to commit a brigade to each of the Baltic states, meaning thousands of soldiers. Right now, there are only a few hundred in each, and because of recent U.S. Army drawdowns in Europe, there are not a huge amount of soldiers who could back them up. So if we committed the levels of forces in that theater that you think are necessary and something bad happened on the Korean Peninsula at the same time, what would happen with the levels of force that we're planning right now in the active component?
So we're planning 450,000 troops in the active component, and if sequestration continues, it could go as low as 420. The problem with 450,000 soldiers when we've looked at it is that First of all, you have to make a lot of assumptions to even believe that we would be in a position to be able to successfully fight in both these. But when we've looked at it, if we committed essentially the whole of the Army and Marine Corps active and reserve component troops on the ground, that means the other things that the Marine Corps is doing, they'd have to suspend other than the embassy guards. And if we deploy them at if we're able to deploy them at levels far greater than the combination of surge operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we keep them deployed for the duration of the combat, and nothing else bad happens anywhere in the world, we might have just enough troops to meet our commitments, but with a couple important caveats. There'd be very little left to replace casualties. And in these kinds of conflicts, casualties would probably be dramatically higher than they were in either Iraq or Afghanistan. We would have very little for reserve in case the war is harder than we thought and turned out that we needed more troops. And we'd have very little left as any kind of a rotation pool to bring troops out of the conflicts periodically to rest if these conflicts went on for more than a year.
Right, so that brings up the point you raised earlier. What are sort of the effects if we stop those rotations and just keep everybody in conflict all the time?
So we found that this is very hard on troops and families. There are stresses that accumulate, there are periods of times when the forces really need to be out of the conflict in order to recuperate and also to reset, in order to be able to train again on some tasks, in order to bring in fresh troops. We also have found that if you don't have periods of time when you bring them out of conflict, they're not going to be able to be turned quickly if something else happens elsewhere in the world. Recall that we've also made a commitment to Japan, to the Philippines. We've now made a commitment to our Persian Gulf allies that if Iran acts in some way aggressively in the Persian Gulf, we'd come to their aid as well. So if you don't have times when you bring troops out, it's going to be very difficult to have a pool of troops that you can then send to something new when it happens. And it's possible that an aggressor might take advantage of that as an opportunity if they're going to choose to act in some belligerent way towards their neighbors.
So let's say that we just kept up those, really punishing deployment cycles for a little while and use that time to build up a force that we needed if any of these emergencies happened. How long would it take to build a bigger army from 450?
So we've tried this before. We did grow the Army some in both the active and the reserve components, and we grew the Marines too during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a very slow process. In our best year, we added about 20,000 active component troops. So if you're at 450 and you need to be at 490, you're talking about 2.5 or 3 years in order to be able to get that troop strength back up. It's not something that can happen quickly. We have an all-volunteer force. You're looking for people to volunteer. You may have to adjust. You may have to provide some waivers to soldiers that you'd be willing to bring in that normally you wouldn't access. But again, people have to decide that this is something they're willing to do. And during the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, they were. But these went on for a very long time, and it's difficult to know what the effects of this kind of a heavy demand on soldiers and families would place on people being willing to continue to join and on the ability to maintain an all-volunteer force that could be at risk.
So in your testimony, if I read it right, you talk about you estimate the total demand that we actually need right now to meet our commitments is about 545,000. What are the options for getting there most realistically?
Well, probably the best option and the thing that is potentially the most readily available is to simply pause the drawdown in current in the forces in both the active and reserve components of the Army. At the end of fiscal year 15, the Army plans to have 490,000 troops in the active component, 352,000 troops in the Army National Guard, and 200,000 troops in the Army Reserve. So probably the best and easiest thing to do as far as being able to maintain the forces needed would be to simply pause that drawdown. Now, One way you could fund that would be with overseas contingency operations dollars. The reason I mention that as a funding source, I mean, we don't go into different funding mechanisms very much in our work, but the reason I mention that is you could make that decision immediately. There are some indications from Congress that they might be willing to provide money that way. I think the Chief of Staff of the Army, General Milley, has talked about OCO dollars in terms of, you know, how it could be useful. So I think something that could be readily at hand as far as a way for the nation to find a way to maintain that funding would be through the overseas contingency operations or OCO dollars. Now, you wouldn't have to continue that forever. Once Russia really pulls back from its current aggression against Ukraine, if it pulled some of the forces back from the borders with its neighbors, and if it really embraced a policy of respecting national boundaries, then you could decide that it might be time to resume that drawdown. But in the meantime, I would maintain that force posture. But you got to do another thing too, and that is you're going to have to test the readiness of active and reserve forces, and you're going to need to improve the ability to provide ready forces. General Odierno, the recent Chief of Staff of the Army, had testified that only about 35% of the active component was ready right now. You'd need to increase that, because we'd be talking about using up to 80% of the active component in the first year of one of these conflicts. And so you would need to do some things to increase the readiness of both the active and the reserve components. And then you'd also like to improve the posture, and that could include pre-positioning more equipment in both the Baltics and Korea to speed force deployments. So those are some other things you should do as well. Even at that, being able to be prepared to fight in both these contingencies would place an enormous burden on the force, and there will still be some stresses, and you still may want to grow the force during these conflicts if they were actually to happen.
One thing that I think some members of Congress might favor is, okay, let's let the drawdown to 450 in the active continue, but then simultaneously build up a really robust reserve component that could deploy to contingencies as needed. What are sort of the pluses and minuses of that?
It's a difficult thing to do. The kind of readiness we're talking about would require a very high degree of training for the reserve components. It would require probably many more days provided by them out of their civilian lives each year to conduct the necessary training. And so at some point, the reserve component would be a very different kind of organization than they are today. They probably would look much more like the active forces in order to be ready for the kind of high-intensity combat that we would have to anticipate with the Russians, or the kind of very difficult operations, say, to take the artillery out of positions that threaten Seoul and other places in South Korea. And so I think the level of training and readiness that would be required would actually cause them to look much more like an active component. So I don't know that, even though it sounds attractive right now from a position of, well, maybe there's a cheaper way to do this, or maybe we can have people do this part-time. I think if you actually took a look at this, and we have, and you looked at what really would be required, I don't think it'd be that different than really saying that, no, we're going to have more active forces, but they'll be called Guard and Reserve Forces.
That's Timothy Bonds from the RAND Corporation. He's the vice president of RAND's Army Research Division. We'll talk more about the Army's drawdown plan after another break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servio. Thanks for listening to federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Timothy Bonds is our guest for this part of the hour. He's the Vice President for Army Research at the RAND Corporation. We're talking about RAND's recent analysis claiming that the Army's current drawdown plan, 450,000 soldiers by 2017, is far too small to meet the defense commitments the U.S. has already made, given the rise of the Islamic State and the explicit promise to defend several of Russia's neighbors against a Ukraine-like invasion. And Tim, your analysis suggests we actually need about 545,000 soldiers to meet our current commitments, given the changing landscape over the past couple years since the last QDR was written. But you also assume a lot of things in that analysis, like the current way that the Army generates forces. I wonder if there are things that the Army could do, just in terms of the way it generates forces, to do it more economically so that you have more of those forces available instead of in the generating force. For example, I'm thinking of things like maybe we don't recruit 120,000 new people every year and cycle that many through on the back end. Maybe we keep people for longer. Are there options like that that could make better use of the money we're already spending on personnel?
So adjusting recruiting is always something that the Army looks at very closely. They have some challenges. They have some challenges with demographics, with the number of young men that are available, and that's part of the reason why it's really important that the Army is looking at also increasing the roles of women in combat forces, that can increase the pool of qualified candidates. But it's a challenge actually bringing enough in. And it's a challenge keeping them. One of the things we've looked at is if you increase the enlistment terms, it has an uncertain effect on the willingness to join up. I mean, if you simply say, well, we're going to keep you for 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years, you may actually get less people coming in rather than more. That's something that really have to be traded carefully. If we're still talking about a volunteer force rather than returning to some form of conscription.
Right.
But you ask another question, too, and that is whether the Army can be more efficient in its generating force. And that is, I think what that ultimately asks is whether the Army can have less uniformed personnel in the generating force and have more in the operating force. The one thing I would observe there is the Army actually has less uniformed personnel in its generating force as a percentage of its service than any other military service. It's at about 29% the last time we looked. The other services are higher, about 45% for the Navy and the Air Force, 31% for the Marine Corps. So when we looked at 2008, even they were a little higher, though the numbers may have changed since them. So the Army's already in some ways too lean in the generating force. I actually worry about that because remember, the generating force is part of the place that is the Army's capabilities factory, and you want that factory to be as capable as possible so you're generating the best Army, not only for the current contingencies but future ones as well. And the degree that you take soldiers out of that for immediate efficiencies, you can damage the long-range viability of the force. Good example of that, Japanese Air Force, when you look at how they performed in World War II, quite competent in the early battles, Coral Sea, Midway, of course at Pearl Harbor, unfortunately competent. But they actually took their best airmen out of their training schools, and they put them into the fleet. The problem with that was when you got down to the Marianas, most of those expert pilots had been killed by them. They weren't able to maintain an excellent pipeline, and that's why later in the war there was such dramatically one-sided air battles where you'd have hundreds of Japanese airplanes, destroyed with maybe just a few on the part of the U.S. So I think there's a cautionary tale there. If you continue to draw down the generating forces of any of the services, if you don't keep those, with the right kind of expertise, you can damage the long-range viability of the services.
I'm sorry, Tim, let me just ask you one more thing, because we haven't really talked about the main topic of your testimony, which was regret. What would happen if we had to confront situations in the Baltics and on the Korean Peninsula at the same time? What would we come to regret from doing that with an insufficiently sized force?
Let me add one thing to that, because there are more regrets beyond that. Remember that the very first thing we committed ourselves to, and since the 2014 Quadrennial Defense Review, or QDR, was issued, was in degrading or ultimately destroying ISIL. And so that was when we reintroduced U.S. ground troops into Iraq and actually maintained the presence in Afghanistan, past the earlier planned exit date of 2014. So let me first say that potential regret in the Middle East of not countering these violent extremist group. One of them could be an enduring ISIL terror state that continues to destabilize its neighbors, harms captured people, exploits captured territory to train terrorists and raise funds and attract new recruits, and maybe ultimately exports that violence to the U.S. and our allies and friends in the form of terrorist attacks. So that's one regret. one of the places you might look for troops is, well, let's pull them out of the Middle East and all those other places. Well, if you do that, you may regret it. So let's turn to the Baltics. You know, what if Russia, you know, takes the same course in the Baltics that it's taken in Ukraine? You might see Russian volunteers entering and destabilizing Estonia and Latvia. Or worse, you could see conventional forces launch a surprise invasion and present a fait accompli, as we say, to NATO. We estimate, as I mentioned to you, that against currently stationed forces, the Russian army could reach the Baltic capitals in 36 to 60 hours. That would leave a U.S. president with few and bad choices. Among them would be the president could negotiate for the Russians to leave. But that'd risk the fracture of NATO if negotiations and sanctions dragged on for months or years. I mean, at that point, it may be that we haven't really protected the territorial integrity of our NATO partners as we promised to do. Or the president could choose to launch a counteroffensive. I mean, having lost those nations, it now would be a counteroffensive to retake their territory. But that'd be against nuclear-armed Russia. And you'll recall that Russia, you know, has made veiled threats about, you know, reserving the right of first use of nuclear weapons if there's an attack on what they consider to be their soil. And they'd almost certainly consider the Baltics at that point to be their soil. In Korea, the regret would be a provocation cycle that leads to an artillery barrage of South Korea that we can't, we no longer have the forces to stop. We would leave Korea on their own to do so from a ground perspective. The notion earlier in the 2014 QDR was that you could win in one place and hold in the other. There isn't really a hold against an artillery barrage. In the historical invasion scenario, you could think about a trading forces that came south. South Korea had a very capable army. But in an artillery barrage, no North Korean forces come south. The South Korean forces would have to go north to stop the artillery attack, and by going into the individual hardened sites and, you know, shooting out, you know, the artillery that is there, that's going to require a very large and capable force. And so for the kinds of, you know, engineering support and logistics support and maneuver support, it'll require U.S. forces too. But the other regret in Korea is that you now have nuclear weapons in North Korea. Sig Hecker estimates you could have, you know, 40 of those by 2020. The Chinese estimate that numbers could be higher, 75 by 2020. So you're talking about a real arsenal. And so if North Korea chooses to use them, or if North Korea collapse and expose them to theft and proliferation, the regret would be you have to either face the use of those weapons on the Korean Peninsula, or the risk those weapons getting loose somewhere else in the world and having to find them before they wound up in a, you know, a U.S. or an allied city. And so those are the kinds of regrets we looked at in our work.
And as you point out, if North Korea did fall, you'd probably want to have a lot of people available to go in and secure the country and find those weapons.
Absolutely. It's as difficult as it's going to be, and it will be difficult. It's got to be easier to find them in a nation the size of North Korea than around the whole world. I guess the last thing I'd say is, you know, the alternative is for us to reduce our commitments. I mean, we could say that we simply are no longer really committed to the defense of an ally or to an operation in ways that we've promised. I think that'd be a mistake. I think that's a mistake that we'd regret.
Tim Bonds is the Vice President for Army Research at the RAND Corporation, talking with us about his analysis of the Army's current drawdown plan and why he thinks it fails to meet the defense commitments the U.S. has already signed up for. We'll switch topics after one final break this hour and hear from the Defense Health Agency about how they're using their new Research and Development Directorate to make DoD medical research more collaborative. This is On DoD on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Switching gears for our final segment of the show this hour as we talk to two guests from the military health system about one of the new directorates within the new Defense Health Agency, Research, Development, and Acquisition. Several hundred of the military's top clinicians wrapped up their annual gathering at the Military Health System Research Symposium in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, earlier this month. For several years, that's been DoD's main venue for sharing medical research and best practices practices. Rear Admiral Bruce Dahl is the director of DHA's new R&D Directorate, and Colonel Todd Rasmussen is the director of the Army's Combat Care Research Program. They join me to talk about the conference, and in this excerpt from our conversation, what DHA's doing to make sure the information sharing continues year-round. Admiral, let me start with you. I mean, I think coordination of research across DOD is kind of one of the main functions of your directorate there at DHA. Can you describe the process a little bit for making sure knowledge does get circulated appropriately during the 51 weeks a year when you're not all together in Florida?
Thank you, Jared. The opportunities that we have a transparent, real-time awareness of all the projects, as you would expect within DOD, and more on a broader scope with our, you might say, sister departments, has been afforded by databases, by the reality that these costs that we talked about before are better used, or I should say the costs are better managed by doing things jointly. That we have looked across our particular services, Army, Navy, Air Force. We've looked at other defense agencies that have a medical research interest and created forums that when we're not here at MHSRS, that we are conducting on a very cyclical basis to ask questions about what are we doing, what's the benefit, when is it going to happen? And from the standpoint of the community that is sitting in the audience that may not be the direct presenters, asking them, is there anything you're doing that potentially synergizes, supports what is being presented? And in doing that regularly, it's a routine event over the other 51 weeks, that we remain aware. And we feel our partnership with NIH in particular, using a database called NIH Reporter, which we are joining, and through a process of IT expertise, we will integrate our project portfolio into it, which the VA is also participating in, that you get even a larger scope of, hey, if I put in certain keywords, orthopedics, trauma, et cetera, what's it going to pull up and who's doing what where, not only for the purposes of within the national interest, but literally the international interest as well, that we are going to grow even a larger capability because the technology is helping us manage this information, help us to enter it on a real-time basis. And as such, make the turnaround in knowledge-based products that change clinical practice guidelines faster, make it possible for us to identify gaps faster. It's clearly the case, as an example on disease surveillance, that you get a few people that come down with a particular series of symptoms, and if they're disparately, if they're separated in various localities, nobody's making the connection. And so when you have databases that start to scan for that, the historical example of Legionnaire's disease, for example, and how that was a detective story that took 5 months to finally determine the etiology, we should see those sorts of experiences expedited in terms of getting from a presentation to what's the etiology, and then what tools do we need or do we have to address it.
Interesting example. So that level of collaboration that's happening right now, is it your sense that at least that level wouldn't be happening without the coordination role that's being played by DHA, or was a lot of this already happening before?
Research is inclined toward collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
We have joined in that theme and enhanced it by being identified as the Defense Health Agency's research go-to, the 911, if you will, on the questions of what is military medical research doing. So we've given to what some who are outside DOD say, geez, how do I get involved with this? What's the way in? I want to collaborate. That acronym, RDA, through venues like the MHSRS continually gets publicized to the general community to say we're the means by which to enhance the experience and the possibility for productive work. But we're standing on the shoulders of giants, if you will. There are numerous examples in the past by various service level efforts that have led to extraordinary advances, and our intent is to build on that.
And Colonel, not to put you on the spot here, but assuming you're one of the customers of this RDA information sharing effort, to what extent are you seeing a difference and seeing value?
Well, I appreciate that question. As a surgeon researcher who really grew up in an era prior to the Defense Health Agency, I can say that that the degree of coordination, not only among the services with the equity, is improved, but there's also been a substantial, I think, collaboration and synergy with what we called our centers of excellence, the defense centers of excellence, which I think, I don't know that we ever really knew what that was or how best to interface with the clinical community of interest for the respective research programs. So, for example, for the Combat Casualty Care Research Program, we now see, I think, in the era of the DHA, a better collaboration with among the services, but also with our two main centers of excellence, COEs. One is the Joint Trauma System Center of Excellence, and the other is the Defense Center of Excellence for Brain Injury and Psychological Health, or what we call DECO, of which one component is the Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center, or DVBIC. And I think the DHA is really, brought together a more natural collaboration with those centers of excellence, which really should bookend, the research effort. On one hand, on the bookend on one side, they should really inform the research activity as to what the needs are, and then on the other end, bookend, they should take the output of the research, whether it's knowledge or material, and implement it into their CPGs or their pathways of care. So I see a better collaboration among the services, the equity, and then I would add the importance that the DHA has provided with learning and working with the centers of excellence.
And Admiral Dahl, just down to our last few minutes here, anything you'd like to add before we close out?
Jared, thanks for making time to spend with us. This is important, both in terms of the opportunity we see for the DHA, RDA, and on the larger scale of this meeting that we've been talking about, to continue what is this effort to keep advancing on those challenges that our operational forces face. And we see right now, at this point, a very exciting period of transition that includes preserving interests and focus in certain areas. I may mention infectious disease, I mentioned TBI and so forth, but also looking to say, where else are we headed? What are the challenges that will come with potentially operating in mega cities? Or where should precision medicine sit? Where should we be positioned when the distances between where an individual is hurt and the very specialized care of a large medical center, that the distances there are extended because of bad weather, because you can't transport them off for other reasons if it's a ship. My point being that these are new challenges. We want to stay ahead of them, and we want to continue to have that soldier, that sailor, that Marine, that airman saying, if I'm going in harm's way, I've got the best medical care backing me up. And so I leave you with, we discover, we develop, and we deliver on those products. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir. And that is Rear Admiral Bruce Dahl, the director of the Defense Health Agency's Directorate for Research, Development, and Acquisition. The other voice you heard there was Colonel Todd Rasmussen, the director of the Army's Combat Care Research Program. They joined me to talk about the recent Military Health System Research Symposium and how DHA is trying to keep the military health system collaborating and sharing information year-round now. Earlier in the show, we talked with Timothy Bonds, the director of the RAND Corporation's Army Research Program, about his analysis finding the Army is planning on far too few troops than it actually needs to handle the defense missions it already has. If you missed that conversation, we'll post this week's full show, as always, at federalnewsradio.com. That's going to do it for this week's edition of On DoD. Thanks, as always, for joining us. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.